This podcast is brought to you by BMJ Best Practice. BMJ Best Practice offers evidence-based, continually updated, and practical knowledge that will help you make better clinical decisions.
Hello and welcome to this BMJ Best Practice podcast on benign paroxysmal positional vertigo, or BPPV. Kieran Walsh is my name. I'm clinical director at BMJ. BPPV has an incidence of 64 per 100,000 per year, increasing by 40% with each decade of life. In real terms, this means about 200,000 new patients per year in the US. And BPPV can cause problems, including falls and accidents, and of course, resultant injuries. So it's important that we get the diagnosis and management of this condition right. To give us more details about this problem and what we can do about it, we have on the line Professor Lauren Parnes of the Departments of ENT, Head and Neck Surgery and Clinical Neurological Sciences at the University of Western Ontario, London, Ontario. And importantly, Lauren is author of our BMJ Best Practice topic on BPPV. So Lauren, you're welcome. Let's start off by asking, what exactly is this condition?
Well, thanks for having me, Kieran. BPPV, as you mentioned, is a very common inner ear condition, the most common inner ear problem that leads to vertigo. It is a mechanical problem of the inner ear, mostly of the posterior semicircular canal. Sometimes it can affect the horizontal semicircular canal and rarely the superior semicircular canal. The function of those canals is to stabilize our gaze and our posture in response to a perturbation of the head or body in space so we can maintain gaze on the target and so we don't fall over. In the BPPV, it used to be thought that there was a dense deposit attached to the cupula. The cupula, some of you may recall, is this little gelatinous membrane that sits in the sensory area of the semicircular canal towards one end. It was thought that fixed dense deposits attached to the cupula made it heavier than the surrounding endolymph, so that when you would turn your head in such a direction that gravity would then pull on that deposit on the cupula, it would cause a false or an abnormal signal to the brain. It would think that the head is accelerating in that plane when in fact it's not. It's just gravity pulling on that. And it tricks the brain into thinking things are spinning around when they're not. It causes the very characteristic nystagmus that we see with BPPV. But it only lasts for about 15 seconds, 10 or 15 seconds, because once a person maintains that new position, that effect of gravity will wear off and that signal will stop. Some things about that theory didn't make sense. It was the best explanation we had, actually, until John Epley. He was really trying to champion the idea that, no, these aren't fixed deposits. These are little crystals. These are something floating around in the fluid. And by turning the head through these certain positions, we could reposition those crystals out of the posterior semicircular canal back into the utricle from whence they came in the first place.
Okay, thank you. And the diagnosis, first of all, how do you make the diagnosis typically, Lauren?
The history is pretty classic. People have short bouts of vertigo in response to certain head movements. Most commonly when they're lying down and they roll over onto one side, and they'll almost always tell you, oh yeah, it's worse on the left side, or it's worse when I go to the right side. So the side to which it's worse is almost always the side that's affected. They also may have it when they look up to, like, for reach for something off a top shelf or look up at the sky. That'll trigger. And the episodes come on. There's a little short latent period, and they only last about 10, 15 seconds, and then they stop. That's the history part. The physical exam, almost everything else on the neuro-otologic physical exam will be normal in most cases, except for what's called the Dix-Hallpike test. The Dix-Hallpike test, you have a patient sitting lengthwise on a stretcher and you turn their head to the side that you're going to test. So if you're testing the right side, you turn the head 45 degrees to the right. That lines up the posterior semicircular canal in the earth vertical plane. And so when you lie them back, which is what you do, you lie them back quickly, it rotates the posterior canal in the plane of gravity. And if there's any crystals sitting at the bottom of that canal, those crystals will move. There's a short latency time for this response, but once they move, the patient will describe feeling vertiginous, and you look at the eyes and you'll see a very characteristic nystagmus. I always say the top pole of the eye beats towards the ground. So if you're testing the right side and you're looking as the examiner at the eyes, you will see a counterclockwise nystagmus. The fast phase will be counterclockwise. And the slow phase, which is the physiologic phase, will be clockwise. But we always name nystagmus in the direction of the fast phase. So it'll crescendo, it'll plateau and decrescendo over about 10 or 15 seconds, and then it'll stop. And the rest of the Dix-Hallpike test is then you sit them back up, look at the eyes again, and the same thing will happen, but in reverse, because now the crystals are moving the opposite direction. And if you do that test two or three times, you will fatigue the response. So two or three times, and then try it again, it won't happen. But if you wait for half an hour, let all the crystals regather at the bottom, then you can reproduce the response again.
Got it. I remember the first time I saw it, I thought it was quite dramatic. Is it safe? Are there any side effects associated with the Dix-Hallpike?
That's a great question. Just to be clear about the canal, so I mentioned the posterior semicircular canal. This can also affect the horizontal semicircular canal, much less commonly. When it's in the horizontal canal, it causes a much more intense nystagmus and a much more intense sensation of vertigo. And some of those patients, when I do the horizontal canal testing and treatment, will actually vomit. But is it safe? It's safe. The one thing you need to look out for is when you're doing the subsequent maneuvers where you have to hang the head back over the edge of the bed. You have to be careful, like in an elderly patient, someone with rheumatoid arthritis, someone with bad vascular disease. You don't want to put too much torque on the neck vessels for fear of causing a stroke. If I'm worried about that, I have a stretcher that can go down in a Trendelenburg position. So if you can't extend the head back, then you have to tilt the table back. They're lying up face up, but I tilt the table back in a Trendelenburg position, and that gets the posterior canal in the right spot.
Okay. And last question about diagnosis specifically. What are the common pitfalls in the diagnosis?
When a patient shows up to the emergency room with acute vertigo, the first thing the eMERGE doc wants to know is it a stroke or is it not a stroke? So they take measures to rule out the stroke. And if they do that, then they say, well, this must be inner ear. And then the patient says, oh, yes, and it's worse if I move. My symptoms are worse if I move. And then they think, whoa, that must be BPPV because BPPV is brought on by head movement. But the important point here is that any acute inner ear event, like a labyrinthitis or a Meniere's attack or whatever it is, the symptoms will be worsened with head movement. The thing with BPPV, though, is if they sit still and don't move their head, they shouldn't have any symptoms. Whereas if it's another acute inner ear event, like a labyrinthitis or vestibular neuritis, they will have symptoms and findings at rest, like findings being nystagmus.
Great. So let's get on. Tell us about the Epley maneuver. How do you do it?
The Epley maneuver, what you do is you have them seated lengthwise on the table, lie them back, just like the first part of the Dix-Hallpike maneuver. But instead of sitting them back up, you have their head hanging back. So if we're testing and treating the right side, their heads turn to the right, their heads hanging back towards the right so that their ear is facing the ground. you wait for the nystagmus to stop. You should see that characteristic nystagmus. And instead of sitting them up to complete the Dix-Hallpike test, now you turn their head with their neck extended towards the other side, in this case, the left side. And you keep their neck extended, and then you continue to roll them over onto the left shoulder, so the opposite shoulder, so that now their nose is facing the bottom corner of the room. So you're effectively turning their head 180 degrees with their neck extended. Once they've gone into that position, they should get another burst of vertigo and another burst of nystagmus. And the nystagmus should beat in the same direction as it was beating during the Dix-Hallpike test, with their head hanging back to the other side. That way, if it's in the same direction, you can feel assured that the crystals have moved in the same direction towards the utricle. And then once they've made that roll, the crystals should be back into the utricle, such that once that nystagmus stops and you sit them back up, they won't have any nystagmus, they won't have any vertigo, because you've cleared the crystals out of the posterior canal. If it doesn't work, if the crystals don't make the turn and they haven't gone into the utricle with the second part of that maneuver, when you sit them back up, they'll fall back the other way. So your patient will get a short bout of vertigo with a nystagmus that may beat in the opposite direction. That's when you know you've made a mistake and you need to do it again. The mistake being is that you haven't extended the head back over the edge of the bed. If you just put the person flat and don't extend the neck and you roll them from the one side to the other, the crystals won't go around that turn. John Epley had this device, he called it the Omniax chair. It looked like an amusement park ride. It was a gyroscope. So patients were seated in this chair. They wore infrared goggles so they could see their eyes. And they could spin these people in any plane in space and watch their eyes. So the ideal maneuver for this is to spin these people in the plane of the posterior canal. So it would be to sit them in a chair, turn their head to the side, and then rotate them 360 degrees with their feet going up over the head in that direction all the way around. And so that would completely spin these crystals out of that posterior canal. But you know what? Doing this on a stretcher, if you have to do it with the Trendelenburg position, it works like 99% of the time.
Okay, great. Thank you. And say it doesn't work. What would you do then, Lauren, I wonder?
Great question, because sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes a patient will come in with an absolute classic history, you know. Yeah, I get it every time in bed for the last months, every time I turn my head to the right. Then you go and you do the physical exam and it hasn't worked. Now, I've actually pioneered an operation where in intractable cases, I find the posterior semicircular canal and I make a little tiny window in the canal. So the canal is 1 millimeter in diameter. So this is meticulous, highly magnified surgery, and I plug off the canal for intractable cases. So those that don't respond to the Epley maneuver or the reposition maneuver, we can cure it, literally cure it, with this surgery. I never use cure for the Epley maneuver because I say control it, because there's a high recurrence rate, so we can control it. But with the posterior canal occlusion, we can cure it. And when I first started doing this procedure, you know, over 30 years ago, I would see these crystals floating around in the endolymph of the posterior canal. And it was like, wow, you know, remembering what John Epley's been preaching, these must be the crystals, the debris in the canal that he's been talking about. I was able to actually extract the membranous labyrinth with the crystals inside of them and sent it to my colleague, Rick Cole, at Washington University in St. Louis, who does scanning electron microscopy of the inner ear. It looks like a riverbed of rocks inside the membranous labyrinth, and they are around the same size of the red blood cells.
Fantastic. It sounds fascinating. But you say that post-Epley, as many as 50% may get a recurrence of the symptoms. And what do you do with them? Do you another Epley maneuver?
I used to tell them to come back, and I still do if they want to. But you know, there's so many people in the community doing maneuvers, you know, physiotherapists, family doctors, chiropractors. My son's an emergency doctor. He can do it, and some of his colleagues do it. I, you know, see patients from quite a far reach around Canada, really. And I only do about two or three of these operations per year. So most of these patients can be controlled using the repositioning maneuvers.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lauren. That sounds like a good point to end it on. And thanks to everybody for listening. We hope this has been helpful, and we hope you'll be able to put what you've learned into action to better diagnose and manage affected patients. If you want to find out more, click the link in the podcast to sign into BMJ Best Practice and look at the content on this and other diseases. Thank you once again.